Good evening. No worksheet tonight. You take a vacation. I've prepared. Oh, okay. It's already up there. I've got a PowerPoint. I won't really go into this until we read through. We've got two chapters to read through tonight. The Judges part of our study is kind of over, and now we're just looking at situations that took place in Israel based on the idea, but the fact that, as it says a couple times in the book, every man did that which was right in his own eyes, and that made for quite a mess in a number of ways. So that's what we're getting into tonight. Get my official church glasses on. There. Do I look any more official now? Chapter 17 and 18 is what we are going to read tonight. I need two readers for chapter 17, 1 through 6. Who would like to take? All right, Ryan, got you right off the bat. And 7 through 13, and we get those read, then we can start talking about this chapter, and we'll get into the PowerPoint. The PowerPoint's so big, it wouldn't send in an email. I had to copy it to a flash drive and give it to Hal, and it's apparently working. All right, Shannon's got our second text in chapter 17, so let's do some reading from Judges. Yes?
There was a man of the hill country of Ephraim whose name was Micah, and he said to his mother, "The 1,100 pieces of silver that were taken from you, about which you uttered a curse and also spoke it in my ears, behold, the silver is with me. I took it." And his mother said, "Blessed be my son by the Lord. Blessed be my son by the Lord." And he restored the 1,100 pieces of silver to his mother. And his mother said, "I dedicated the silver to the Lord for my hand for my son to make a carved image and a metal image. Now therefore I will restore it to you." So when he restored the money to his mother took 200 pieces of silver and gave it to the silversmith, who made it into a carved image and a metal image, and it was in the house of Micah. And the man Micah had a shrine, and he made an ephod and household gods, and ordained one of his sons who became his priest. In those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes.
Young Levite from Bethlehem in Judah, who had been living within the clan of Judah, left that town in search of some other place to stay. On his way, he came to Micah's house in the hill country of Ephraim. Micah asked him, "Where are you from?" "I'm a Levite from Bethlehem in Judah, and I'm looking for a place to stay." Then Micah said to him, "Live with me and be my father and priest, and I'll give you 10 shekels of silver a year, your clothes and your food." So the Levite agreed to live with him, and the young man was to him like one of his sons. Then Micah installed the Levite, and the young man became his priest and lived in his house. And Micah said, "Now I know that the Lord will be good to me, since this Levite has become my priest."
Do we need to read that again? That's just some weird stuff, isn't it? So here we go. He steals 1,100 pieces of silver from his mom, and he tells her about it, and I'll put it this way, she blesses him out. What does it say she did? "Blessed be my son by the Lord." And I'm wondering, okay, what Lord is she talking about? Because what does she do with the money? He returns the money. His mother says, "I wholly dedicate the silver from my hand to the Lord for my son to make a what? A graven image." A graven image of what? Of whatever. Apparently, we don't know what it was. Graven image, a molten image. "And now therefore I will return them to you." In other words, they were going to take some of that silver and work that into an image of an idol of some kind. And he had a shrine to put that place in. And it says, when he returned the silver to his mother took 200 pieces of silver, gave them to the silversmith, who made them into a graven image and a molten image, and they were in the house of Micah. And he had a shrine, he made an ephod. What's an ephod? It's like an upper garment, something you would wear on a special occasion. I think of it as like a really fancy apron, but that's an ephod. It might have been a little different than that, but that's the idea of an ephod anyway. So he made an ephod and household idols and consecrated one of his sons that he might become his priest. How do you consecrate somebody to serve in that capacity? When you read in Exodus, God gave Moses specific instructions on how to ordain or consecrate the men who were to be priests, and it was very specific who they were supposed to be. Who were the only ones who could serve as priests? What family did they have to be from? Had to be from the tribe of Levi, and they couldn't have any blemishes. They had to be good physical specimens. Who were the only ones who could serve as high priests? Aaron was the high priest at that time, and his sons would be the successors after him. And they had to be very specifically ordained. All the clothing, there had to be a baptism, if you will, a washing, incense, all that stuff. Anyway, so think about what they know. They know they need a priest. By the way, were there priests before the Mosaic Law? Were there priests before? There were. Can you name any of them? Melchizedek was one. All the way back to Genesis chapter 14, there was Melchizedek. Can you think of another priest who was not of any Mosaic law? Yes, Moses' father-in-law, Jethro, was a priest. A priest of Midian, but he was a priest of God. I don't know how all that worked out. But it's interesting to me that there were priests at the time through whom people could approach God. And we don't know anything about that. We don't need to know anything about that. It's just a thing of interest to it. I have to confess, you know, I always say this thing about need one more verse. But I'm also glad God didn't put everything in there that I'm curious about, because I wouldn't be able to carry the book around without help. So there are those things. He knew there needed to be a priest, knew there needed to be a consecration for priests. All these things seem to be common knowledge. There needed to be an article of worship. There was a shrine. What would it's not a shrine, but what would be any kind of a counterpart in Judaism, in legitimate religion? Might be an altar. So there's something there. And this is the way the thought process apparently went in those days, that there had to be some physical aspects about which we could approach. Now, thinking about that and overlaying that on what we have today in the Lord's church, are you not grateful for spirituality as God has given it to us today? We don't have to make a pilgrimage anywhere. Glad for that. We're obligated to meet one day of the week, on the first day of the week. And what do we do on that day? You got to bring your bulls and your calves and your goats so we can slaughter them out there in the parking lot. No, don't have to do any of that, do we? We just show up. There's already some unleavened bread and fruit of the vine provided. Somebody's going to lead us in songs. Fruit of our lips, sacrifice, Hebrews 13 says. We pray to the God who has saved us through his son's blood. All of this is just so simple and so easy that, wow, why don't we do this? Well, we do, but we might ask everybody else in the world, why don't you give this simple recognition to God? Paul?
Everybody pretty much knows we are priests now.
We're what?
We are considered priests now.
Yes.
Not in exactly in the same sense, but we can approach the Lord without ritual.
We're a nation of priests, a holy priesthood. Peter wrote about that. And the idea is we are the people, the salt of the earth, not bragging, not getting the big head. We are the cities on hills. We are the representatives of Christ on the earth. We are his children. He's put his spirit in us. Nothing arrogant about that, or holier than thou, or better than thou, because the fact of the matter is none of us are better than anybody else who's lost. The only thing different about us is we're covered by the blood. That's the only thing that's different. I don't have enough righteousness to make me better than anybody, but we are covered by the blood, and that makes us holy, and being holy is a very different thing from what we're looking at here. Mike?
You said at the beginning, you said, wow, what a weird thing that we just read this, but
Exactly.
Realize they need a priest, so I'll, I'll get somebody in my family to be a priest. They realize that in the tabernacle there was the Ark of the Covenant, there were land, there were things there. Well, where did they get those ideas? Well, they borrowed them from the tribes, from the pagan tribes that survived around them that they should not have allowed to survive. So, in other words, they're mixing the religion that they were given with the religion of the people around them. And this is what you get. This hybrid type of religion is what you get.
Right. And tell me there's not hybrid Christianity being practiced all over the planet right now. And I don't say that in an ugly, hateful way, but here's the thing. Genesis chapter 3, what happens? Everything's clear. Adam and Eve know everything they need to know about how to do the right thing before God. Satan comes in, lies to them, and then everything's shot to pieces. And then what do you see in chapter 4? Well, Cain and Abel come before God. Abel has a sacrifice. What's God think of Abel's sacrifice? It's a good sacrifice. He's pleased with it. What's he think of Cain's sacrifice? He's not pleased with Cain's sacrifice. Cain got his nose out of joint. It's kind of what it says, And God asked him a question. If you do right, won't you be accepted? That is such a probing question. And all you have to do, Cain, is the same thing your brother did. Why didn't he do that? Was he so arrogant? I don't know. But he didn't do it. He wouldn't follow through. And you know how that turned out. That's the first murder. It was over religious practice. It was over faith. It was over whether or not you're going to do the right thing before God or not. And when Cain did, it made his brother angry, and that's how that came out. So now we're here, and every man's doing what's right in his own eyes. And there doesn't have to be any commentary on that because we know how that's going to turn out. Everybody does what they think's right. It's not going to be right. There's got to be a standard, and there is no standard. So chapter 17, verse 7. There was a young man from Bethlehem in Judah, of the family of Judah, who was a Levite. He was staying there. Why wasn't he in the land given to the Levites? The Levites weren't given any land. They were spread out through the nation because they were the men who were supposed to be teaching about the law. When the man departed from the city, from Bethlehem in Judah, to stay wherever he might find a place as he made his journey, he came to the hill country of Ephraim, to the house of Micah. Well, who's Micah? He's the guy that just made an idol. He just made an ephod. He's got a shrine. They're going to worship the Lord through an idol. Wow, this is crazy. So you'd think, what would the Levite do when he gets there, sees all this? Oh, brother, I need to talk to you. We need to get back to the Lord. We need to figure out what you're doing here. So Micah says to him in verse 9, where do you come from? He said, I'm a Levi from Bethlehem in Judah, and I'm going to stay wherever I might find a place. Micah then said to him, dwell with me and be a father and a priest to me, and I'll give you 10 pieces of silver a year, a suit of clothes, and your maintenance. So the Levite went in. Levite agreed to live with the man. The young man became to him like one of his sons. Micah consecrated the Levite. Whoa, whoa, whoa. How do you consecrate a Levite when you're not even a Levite? Interesting. How do you allow somebody to consecrate you? Anyway, the young man became his priest and lived in the house of Micah. Micah said, now I know that the Lord will prosper me because I got myself a priest. I just have to say that like a redneck would say it, because it's kind of what this is like to me. I think I'm going to do it this way. But the Levite's going along with it. Why doesn't he know better? I don't know. This is just weird. It's going to get weirder, though. Hang on. Yes, sir.
The Levite, if he was less than 50 years old, should have had a duty that he was responsible for.
Yes. And so until what age?
Since he's till 50.
Till 50.
And so, but since he's just wandering about, he doesn't have a duty.
Right. So. Well, and he doesn't even seem to have a plan. I'm just going about trying to find my place, myself a place to light. And here I am. I got a place with Micah. I can be his priest. I get some money. I get silver and maintenance. Yeah.
You wonder where he got that? He just looked around what other people were kind of doing. He was working out, so
yeah.
Didn't have any other
Right. Now, part of me wants to give them credit, both of them, because they're seeking out God. So I got to give them some credit. And also, I need to remember, I live in a great time. I've been taught how to read. I've got plenty of reading material available. How many different translations of the Bible can I get my hands on in 10 minutes? They're just everywhere. And now, if I don't have a hard copy, as we call it, I got a blue Bible right there. And it's almost easier to read than the one I can hold in my hand. Well, I hold it in my hand, but you know what I'm saying. And if I have a question, commentaries are readily available. Websites, wonderful websites by people who are scholarly in the scriptures. You want to know the origin of a Greek or a Hebrew word? How long is it going to take? Google it right now. I can give you any Hebrew, Greek word. You could Google it, and you could tell me in less than 3 minutes, probably, if you're between the ages of 7 and 11, you could probably tell me in 30 seconds. What did these folks have? And I don't know what they had. I don't know if they had a copy of the law. I don't know how much training they had, even in literacy. I don't know any of those things. Absolutely. Absolutely. You go back to Deuteronomy chapter 6, and this is the Israelite indoctrination 101, you might say, and I don't mean indoctrination in a bad way. Deuteronomy chapter 6, 1. This is the commandment, the statutes, and the judgments which the Lord your God has commanded me to teach you, that you might do them in the land where you are going over to possess it, so that you and your son and your grandson might fear the Lord your God to keep all his statutes and his commandments, which I command you all the days of your life, that your days may be prolonged. O Israel, you should listen and be careful to do it, that it may be well with you and that you may multiply greatly, just as the Lord God of your fathers has promised you, in a land flowing with milk and honey. And then he says, what we sing, hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one. You shall love the Lord your God. That's the greatest commandment, Jesus said. And then he gets down, he says, these words which I'm commanding you shall be on your heart. You shall teach them diligently. Who? To your sons. Talk of them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, when you lie down, when you rise up. Bind them as a sign on your hand. They'll be as frontals on your forehead. Don't let this word get away from you. Well, what had happened in the day of the judges? The word had gotten away from them. Somebody wasn't passing it on. Somebody wasn't soaking it up. And things are a mess. Seems to be, I'm encouraged so much. When I read, I read a statistic that bothered me, and then right after that I read another statistic that encouraged me. Young people are giving up on churches. That's a discouraging thing, but young people are buying Bibles. I think that's something very telling, and we've got to be ready to capitalize on that. That we might strike when the iron is hot and when people give us an opportunity. Magnify the Lord. Paul?
I think mankind is just innately predisposed to trying to worship something greater than itself. The problem is how that worship manifests itself, whether you use the roadmap, whether you use the plan, the template, whatever you want to call it, that the Lord has given us, or whether you use some other device. And we see so many different flavors, for lack of better description, of religion, and some of them are completely wacky, some of them are downright sinful. We see, you know, temple prostitutes. I mean, good grief. To us, that's like, are you kidding me? But that's what happens when man is the guide of how that natural drive manifests itself. Without the guide, I mean, you can get wacky real quick.
Yeah. It's interesting to me. You know, Debbie's into her heritage, and they have a pageant over in Yukon. It's a Czech pageant, and the girls study Czech history and language and ethnic cultures and all that stuff. And then they have to create a croy. A croy is a costume, and they wear that costume. And in talking with her friend that she met in the Czech Republic who is Czech and who makes dolls with these croy on them. She was talking about American croy. Do they not have a petticoat under there? Well, we don't have that over here. It's not the same thing. We go, I forget, it might be a petticoat, but she told Debbie, well, if you're in the Czech Republic and you don't have at least five, you're a hussy. So, what? What happened to that law? That just kind of got knocked by the wayside. Now, that's just a human cultural thing, but that's what happens. Everything shifts when it comes over to another place, another country, and you start life all over. Well, you're going to lose something. And so now they're studying, trying to get back to the original things. But some of it they're finding is so difficult. Well, it's just, we're going to call it Americanized. And we're not going to have five petticoats or whatever. And anyway, that's just a brief kind of an analogy as to how these things go. But we're not talking about how we dress. We're talking about God. And I hate that anybody might be in such ignorance that they don't have a way to approach God that would be good. And I don't know what God thought of all this. I just know he's recording it for us so we can read it. Bobby?
I was just thinking that the culture that was influencing them, same culture influences us.
Mm-hmm.
That's why a lot of the religions are okay for a little while and then they shift because the culture changes and we want to keep up with what's modern, so therefore we follow the culture and sooner or later we're far away from where we began.
And things change gradually. When I was a kid, you didn't say the word pregnant. You just didn't say that out loud in polite company. And now we got 15 different ways to describe it, and there's a whole list of words that never used to come out of my mouth because I knew I'd get smacked, and those are just commonly used today that you wouldn't even think of. And I'm not saying that's bad or good. I'm just saying that's the way it is, and that's the way things change. And so you got to be careful that what you're holding on to is really what's of God, and what you're letting go of is okay, because it's not of God. Mike?
Right. The last verse in this chapter, in those times, every man did what was right according to his own eyes. And we think, oh, wow, look at that. That's in the Bible. That's 3,000 years ago or whatever it is. And yet that's exactly the mindset of our society today.
Right.
Every man, every person does according to what they believe. You know, my truth.
Right. Exactly.
This kind of chaos, this kind of, you know, hybrid everything, you know, where nothing makes sense. I'm just trying to make the point that this is a very pertinent, very, you know,
relevant.
Relevant.
Yeah.
A very relevant chapter to what we're living in today. And one step further, you said that they're buying more Bibles. We must have read the same article because I was surprised too. Less people.
Right.
And the beauty of the restoration churches, of which we are one, Church of Christ, the beauty of it is that we are calling out to people to come back to the plan. In other words, I sincerely believe we have the right message. Of course, it's the gospel. But what I'm saying, the approach that we have, I believe, is the correct approach. Let's go back to the original plan, and let's just stick to that original plan, and it'll produce, you know, something that's good. And I just hope that more brethren would have that kind of enthusiasm. We've got the right thing, you know.
Right.
Get it out of the building.
Absolutely. And are you not grateful that God didn't say, now be ready for updates. Things are going to change along the way. I'm so glad that as a minister, I don't have to worry about finding the next book from God and studying that one and figure out how that goes. It's all right here. It's so simple, if you will. Don?
To be sure that we don't get our chest too puffed up, I liked our old mantra. I don't know if it's still up, but it says we're trying to be the church Christ Jesus built. Because just right here within a few miles, we've got other churches of Christ that completely believe different things than we believe. And sometimes they don't even fellowship with us.
You're right.
And so I'm not trying to bring that up to make a big deal about it, but it's there. And they have beliefs that they say we're doing something wrong. And so we want to make sure that we're praying about those things, not getting our chest out saying, we got it all right. We're trying to get it all right. And we need to always continually search and not think that we're perfect. We need to be calling upon the name of the Lord at all times.
Right. The thing is, we know there's got to be a standard, and the standard is God and His Word. And if we stick with that standard, that's what's got to be our standard as Christians. There isn't anything else. There isn't anything else except our own opinions, and we know how much trouble those will get us into. But we come back to the Word, come back to the Bible. It doesn't change. It hasn't changed. It's still as relevant now as it was 3,000 years ago. So that's what we're looking at here. And well, I tell you what, let's do. Let's go ahead. The reason I wanted to show you these things is because in the next chapter, we're going to be talking about how the tribe of Dan goes up to northern Israel and takes the city of Lachish or Laish from some peaceful people, and they make their dwelling there. I wanted to show you that because we got to go there a couple years ago when we were in Israel. This is the Tel Dan National Park, northern Israel. That doesn't mean go Tel Dan. That means a tel is a mound or a hill. It's a place they find that has history buried in it, and they start uncovering that history little by little. Archaeologists and paleontologists and the people who dig up things from the past. Well, there could be a joke there, but I'm not going to go. Anyway, that's what this place is. They found that up here in northern Israel, and they made it into a park. And multiple springs on Mount Hermon. You've heard of Mount Hermon. This is way up north. It's in the area of Dan. They flow down, forming the Dan River, which later splits into other rivers, and then they eventually come back together and rejoin to become the Jordan River. But if anybody else in here has seen the Jordan River, you know it doesn't look like that. That's beautiful. Jordan River doesn't look quite like that. Jordan River is beautiful for another reason. Water's cold, clear, and refreshing in large part because it results from the melting snow atop Mount Hermon. It's way up there. It gets snowed on. The snow melts and goes into the mountain, makes it marshy, but it starts coming out in different places, and that's what creates this beautiful river. For natural beauty, when you go to Israel, you're going to look around. It's going to be rocks and desert everywhere, but you go up north, and this is what you see. It's beautiful up there. And unless you just like desert, that's the most beautiful place there is. So this is the signage we ran into up there, where we're going to go, where we're going to the gate. That's what that picture represents. It tells you the direction, tells you it's a footpath, tells you what your destination is. And it's got pictographs in case you don't read any of the languages that are presented. But the two languages that are presented are Hebrew and English, but there's also Arabic. Also very interesting, I think. And the closer you get to your destination, the more rustic you'll find the signage to be. And I like that. Here's another rustic sign talking about the Israelite gate in Dan. This is the place that the Danites went up and took. They renamed it in honor of their patriarch. And this map, you can see that gate that we were just talking about there is the one right on the other end of that little arrow. And you see those blue things over on the left of the map. Those are the headwaters of the Jordan River. So I just give you a little bit of orientation. And there's what the gate looks like as you approach it from some distance, and you get up a little closer and you see this little sign that says this. First, I'll read the Hebrew. Right. It says, therefore, the children of Dan went up to fight against Leshent. That's another thing about foreign languages. They called towns different names all the time, and it's all okay. It's all legit. And they took it, and they dwelt there, and they called it Leshem, Dan, after the name of Dan, their father. And you see the reference? That's Joshua 19:47. And here we've got it in chapter 18 telling us when exactly they did that. So let's go on to the gate. There is my grandson Liam sitting at the gate. And this is important because the gate of the city is where all the commerce took place. The king would come out there and sit for judgment. People would bring their legal cases to him, and he would judge. The elders of the city would be out there. You read about this a lot in the Old Testament, especially. Elders in the gate and the king at the gate, judgment taking place at the gate, business going on at the gate. So this is the Israelite gate. And here's another view of it. You can see that sign back there. That guy in front of the sign was our guide, Michael. Very interesting story. We'll see a picture a little later. Oh, I don't know if I put that in there. But every healthy young person in Israel has to serve in the military for a term. And he served, and he fought in battles up in the north, up around Mount Hermon and Dan, Tel Dan, where we're talking about. And he was a medic, and he said, I had friends die, and I had them die in my arms, and said, that's when I decided I need to do something about eternity. And he became a Christian. He came to be a believer in Christ, even though he was raised a Jewish man. And I thought it's very, and now he's leading people on tours. And you don't just, hey, I'd like to lead some people on a tour. You got to go to school over there. 2 years, you got to go to school. And you got to learn a lot of stuff. It's a very intense, and I knew it was because he never stopped talking. And I'm saying that with the utmost respect, because everything out of his mouth was information about Israel and where we were going and where we had been and the history, everything. He knew it all. I was amazed at his knowledge. But it's because, number one, he's a smart guy and he's committed, but he also trained for 2 years to become a guide. That sign behind him gives you an idea. You can read that print, can't you? Anyway, that's there to give you an idea of what went on at that gate. They've unearthed this, and they want us to be advised that this is what happened at the gate. Instead of just walking up and looking and not knowing what anything was, they try to provide some information so you'd be aware. Other views from as you go through the gate, you get an idea of what this place might have been like in its heyday. It's up high. It's on top of a hill. It's not on top of Mount Hermon, but it's on top of like a foothill just below Mount Hermon, and it's very beautiful area. Some more ruins. They're sifting through these, seeing what they can find. And, of course, the initial build was 4,000 years ago or thereabouts, and things have been built on top of it since. And you're not allowed to go into a lot of these places. It's fenced off. You can just look at it and take pictures. Now, we're going to come around to the Golden Calf Shrine that's pictured at the top. If you see down at the bottom, the Israelite gate, that's where we were, and we just walked around to the left and came back around to the top where the Israelite or the Golden Calf Shrine is. So let's take a look at that. And here's a quote. Now this was after the time of the judges when the nation of Israel split. You may remember why they split. Solomon died, and his son Rehoboam was supposed to be king, or did become king, and instead of relieving the people of the heavy taxation that Solomon was putting on them, he increased the taxation. The people rebelled, and so the nation split. 10 northern tribes went to the north, and Judah and Benjamin stayed to the south. But Jeroboam, the one who took the 10 northern tribes away, said, if I don't institute some idolatry here, the people are going to be going back to Jerusalem to worship. And so he put a golden calf in the south and a golden calf in the north, and the one that went to the north was right here at this place. This is history. And it's also interesting, again, why didn't the people rebel against that and say, what are you talking about, a golden calf? That's stupid. We worship God. We're going to Jerusalem. No, didn't happen. So here is the place. That picture on the left, you see us sitting at the top? That's the area where the golden calf would have been, right behind where we are sitting. And so these steps would have been the approach to the golden calf. That's where it would sit up there. Now, you can see Michael is sitting on that low wall. Looks like a low wall from where we are. But if you flip the camera around, now we're looking at Michael as he leans against that wall. And behind him is a facsimile of the old altar. See, they did all the same things as far as sacrifice, altar, priests, All of that was brought over and included in their false religion. The only difference was, instead of worshiping the true and living God, they're bowing before a golden calf. And this is the place where that happened in the north of Israel. So consider the irony. Most beautiful place that I saw in Israel anyway, for my eye and my senses, was the place where the worst heresy took place among the people of God, worshiping a golden calf. And here is a sign that would tell you somewhat about how they went about worshiping. Kill the calf, take the blood, do all the same similar things. Now, back to the map. We're coming on around over the top and down to the bottom where you see the sign there that says Canaanite Gate, 2200 B.C., so that's over 4,000 years ago that gate was there. That gate is also called the Abrahamic Gate. When you read in the chapter 14 of Genesis that Lot and his family, which were living in Sodom and Gomorrah, were taken captive, Abraham took his 318 trained men and he pursued Chedorlaomer, the cheese king, and all those who took his family captive, pursued them as far as Dan. And so that's why this is called the Abrahamic Gate, because it dates to the time of Abraham, and that's the connection they make with it. But it's also called the Canaanite Gate. And there it is. You see a model of it there in that smaller picture. So you can get an idea of what it must have been like when it was in its heyday, as we might say. But there is also the remains of it under that cover. So this is all in northern Israel in the area of Dan that we're reading about here in chapter 18 and 19. All right, this is a very significant find in that area. This is the Tel Dan Stela, and it was discovered in 1993. It dates back to the 9th century, which would be the 800s B.C., and it mentions the house of David. There are things such as this that we might take for granted because we read them in the Bible, but people who are skeptics say, there's no evidence that David ever even existed. Well, then, boom, 1993, they find this 2,800-year-old stone carved in it, reference to the house of David. So, okay, maybe there was a David. Maybe he was important enough to have what's called the House of David, which is an interesting quote to be left on that stone because of all the things that stone probably had on it, that's what's there. And why is that of interest? What did David want to do for God? He wanted to build him a temple. God said, I didn't ask for a temple, but here's what I'm going to do. You want to build me a house? I'm going to build you a house. And he wasn't talking about a building. He was talking about his lineage and preserving his throne down through the ages until God would bring his son into the world, who would be son of David. And that's huge. And here we have this piece of evidence dug up, much larger stone than what we see here, but this piece has a reference to the house of David on it. Very interesting to me. I think that's the end of it. Yeah, okay. Well, let's see if we can read the 19th chapter in 5 minutes and discuss it. Maybe not. Maybe not. This is pretty intense. Have you gone ahead and looked ahead to read the 19th chapter and see what's in it? Yes.
Chapter 18 talks about the Danites still seeking their inheritance.
Yes, go back to chapter 1. I'm glad you brought that up. Now, I have to confess, I'm not hearing everything you're saying, but you're asking, if I'm not mistaken, about why they don't have an inheritance?
Right.
Okay.
Earlier in the Bible, it says they were busy taking their inheritance, thinking about the sword, according to the picture you showed us back in Joshua, it mentioned them thinking of the land.
Oh. Okay. I don't know why. I'm having such a hard time finding chapter 1. I used to know Numbers pretty well. All right, Judges chapter 1, verse 34. It says, the Amorites forced the sons of Dan into the hill country, for they did not allow them to come down to the valley. Yet the Amorites persisted in living in Mount Heres, in Ajalon, and in Shalbim. But when the power of the house of Joseph grew strong, they became forced labor. The border of the Amorites ran from the ascent of Akrabim, from Selah and upward. In other words, it's not clear that Dan ever fully took the land that they were given on paper, so to speak. So they're fussing about, we don't have a place to be. Where are we going to be? Well, they shoot way up north because everybody else, all the other land is taken. So they, well, let's go up to the border. Let's go across the border. We'll look out up there and we'll find a place to take. And that's what they did. And if you read the text, it says that the people that they encountered up there were living peacefully. There's no indication that they were a great military power or anything like that. They just lived peacefully, and they said, we're going to go up there and take it, and that's what they did. It's just, there's more. I want more. I want more information. And God is saying, I'm giving you all you need to know about this. You read it, and you figure out what's important here. It's almost as if God trusts us to give us just enough information to know what's important and to figure things out. I find that reassuring in I don't want to say an odd way, but I find it reassuring. Mike?
So they couldn't to overcome the Amorites, so they went north for easier pickings, you know, in order to just have a land. However, if you ask the question, why couldn't they overcome the Amorites, whereas other tribes did so? You know, they managed to overcome the locals, the Canaanites, and the Hittites, and you know, all the others. Well, you see the extreme way that Dan had fallen from the, you know, from the original law, even putting a golden calf for worship. It seems to me what they didn't do is they didn't rely on God to help them overcome. They used human reasoning. These guys are hard. Let's go find somebody easier to beat, and we'll sell there.
Yeah.
And of course, it ends up with what we read in chapter 17.
Yeah, it's, and you see the humanity through all of this. They're just people. They're just people like us. We're people. They're people. We got goofy things we do. They got goofy things they did. And all of this, I'm sure to a lot of folks, I probably sound like I'm very judgmental and I'm looking down my nose at them. But I'm just trying to report, this is what's in the book. And what they did was insane. It was crazy. They were unguided, going by the seat of their pants. But it comes back to the fact that they didn't have to be. Nobody has to be unguided. Nobody has to fly by the seat of their pants. If you draw near to God, what will he do? He will draw near to you. If you resist the devil, what will he do? He will flee. Jesus talked about two ways, a broad way and a narrow way. He said the broad way is one where many go in, and few find the narrow way. So this is history. And by the time this was given, it was all over. And there wasn't anything else that needed to be known except what's here. We'll finish up the 19th chapter. It's X-rated, but we'll do it anyway next week. Thank you. Appreciate it.